To our kingly lesson for tonight, we are in 2 Kings chapter 19. We'll probably need to play catch up here because it's been a couple of weeks. Last week, Ed filled in for me, and last week was a fifth Sunday, and so we did Bible trivia, and the week before that, Ed filled in for me. So it's been 3 weeks since we've been in this passage, and we'll try to do a little bit of review here quickly. We're studying the life of a king of Judah named Hezekiah. And contrary to some people's belief, Hezekiah does not have a biblical book named after him. So if anybody asks you to turn to the book of Hezekiah, don't try to find it. It doesn't exist. It sounds like it should be one of the prophets, but it doesn't. Hello, Paulies. Oh, great. Glad to have you. Okay. Oh, okay. Did he? Yeah, yeah. All right, Dieter Zoff passed away yesterday. An obituary will probably be out with the information in the next couple of days then, or did it come out already? What's that? Oh, is that where he's at? Oh, okay. Okay. So, Hezekiah is a pretty well-known character. How about his upbringing? His dad Ahaz. Anybody remember what Daddy Ahaz was like, Tim? Ahaz sacrificed his children to the gods of the pagan nations around Israel. So, not a very righteous guy. If we can even say it that lightly, not a righteous man at all. He brought in all kinds of paganism, idol worship into Jerusalem. He even shut down the temple for a little while. And Hezekiah, when he took the throne, had to restore things. And so the first couple of years of Hezekiah's reign were spent in reform, in trying to restore temple worship. He even invited the northern kingdom of Israel down for a Passover celebration. Now, most of the Israelites from the north didn't come, but some of them did. Just a few short years into his reign, in his third year, the Assyrian king Shalmaneser laid siege to the northern capital of Samaria, and for 3 years locked everybody up in the city and then finally captured it. Whoever he didn't kill, he took off into captivity, and the northern kingdom ceased to be an entity. It's no longer a political force. It's a sparsely populated area because the Assyrians deported everybody. They didn't deport everybody, just mostly everybody. And so they took them off and scattered them throughout the Assyrian Empire. And a little bit later on, they're going to bring in other peoples from other places in the Assyrian Empire, and that'll be the birth of the Samaritan people. But the period we're studying is right around here in the middle of Hezekiah's reign. And so Hezekiah decides early in his reign that he's going to revolt from the king of Assyria. He no longer wants to pay tribute to the big mighty Assyrian Empire, so he stops. How does Assyria respond to that? They come in and engage in a campaign against Judah. And that's what we're studying right now. So the beginning of chapter 18, no, I'm sorry, we're in 2 Kings chapter 18. We're kind of summarizing verse 13 and following. So 2 Kings 18, verse 13. Verse 13 tells us that these events begin in which year? In the 14th year of his reign, right. So we're in the 14th year of his reign, which according on our timeline is right around here, okay? 14th year of his reign. Some interesting little tidbits that come up when you look into the timing of this are: how long did Hezekiah rule? If you look back to chapter 18, verse 2. Twenty-nine years. He rules for a total of 29 years. We're looking at the 14th year, So he's got 15 years left. Now, does anybody remember an account, which we're going to get to shortly, of Hezekiah getting sick? And he prays to God, and God grants him healing and actually tells him how much longer his life will last. How long does God tell him his life will last? It's not two, it's longer than two. Oh, 10, I'm sorry. Yeah, it's actually a little bit longer than 10 as well. What's that, Tim? It's 15 years. Okay? So he gets sick, and God tells him you're going to have 15 years. Well, if he actually reigned 25 years, back up 15, that tells us the sickness happened in which year of his rule? The 14th year. So the same year that Sennacherib comes down and starts this military campaign against Judah, Hezekiah gets deathly sick. Now, the writer of the book of 2 Kings is not going to talk about that incident yet because sometimes they put things in topical order. And so he wants to deal with this whole Assyrian invasion thing before he moves on to Hezekiah's sickness. But I just want us to keep in mind that when we get to chapter 20 and we start talking about Hezekiah's sickness, we're actually backing up in time, okay? The events of chapter 18, starting in verse 13, with this Assyrian invasion, actually cover several years, which we're going to see here in just a few minutes. But there's some great lessons for us. So the 14th year of Hezekiah's reign is when this thing begins. Sennacherib is invading, and Sennacherib at this point is actually not the king of Assyria. He's the son of he's the Tartan, which is kind of their supreme commander of the army. He will later become king, and so the writer of Kings is comfortable calling him king at this point, because he will become king later on. So the actual king is Sargon II, the king of Assyria. Sennacherib, who will become king later, is at this point called the Tartan, or the supreme general of the Assyrian army. So when Sennacherib comes down, he is acting with all of the authority of the king of Syria. I'm about to lose my battery. Hold on. Or we're going to go dark. It'll give me a warning. Yeah, well. Yep. Somebody unplug me. I gotta play Twister to get down there. All right. There we go. Now we're charging again. So, Sargon, the king of Assyria, has sent Sennacherib, his Tartan, down into Judah to stop Hezekiah from rebelling. We know from some other historical sources that Judah is not the only country rebelling against Assyria at this time. I forgot to bring up my map, so I'll try to talk while I'm bringing this up, and we'll see how that works. Okay, but some other countries are sensing that there's a little bit of weakness in Assyria at this point, and so they're all pressing against Assyria, trying to find some weak points. And Assyria is responding with vehement force to put down these uprisings. Because obviously you don't want these people rebelling against your rule, or you lose out in huge amounts of tax revenue and tribute coming into your country. I'll zoom out as far as I can go so that we can kind of get a lay of the land. But if you remember, Assyria is over here. The capital is Nineveh. It's this little dot right there. That's the capital of Nineveh. You should recognize that. It's the city Jonah went and preached to. Jonah happened about 100 years before this and actually caused a lull in Assyrian military activity because they repented of their wickedness. And we see that in the historical record, that the kings during that era, when Jonah preached, actually stopped advancing their armies outward. But at this point, Assyria is in full tilt again. They are expanding as quickly as they can. They have conquered... Oh, I can go out again. they have conquered all of this area, which is called Babylon, and Elam. Elam is up here in the north, Babylon's down here, the Medes are over this way, and the Persians even farther out. Assyria has conquered most of this region. They have subdued Syria. They have conquered the northern kingdom of Israel. And now they're pushing south. Their ultimate goal is to try to capture Egypt. Everybody who wants to control the world in the ancient world, you have to get a hold of Egypt, because it's one of the most productive for grain, and you need control of that. So they're pushing down this way, and they have come to Hezekiah, and they have captured all of the fortified cities in Judah. So we get this description in verse 13. The 14th year, this is 2 Kings 18, verse 13. In the 14th year of King Hezekiah, Sennacherib, king of Assyria, came up against all the fortified cities of Judah and took them. And Hezekiah, king of Judah, sent to the king of Assyria at Lachish, saying, I've done wrong. Withdraw from me. Whatever you impose on me, I will bear. So this military incursion ends with Hezekiah surrendering. He says, okay, whatever you put on me, I'll bear the tax burden and we'll pay you. Just leave us alone. And so for a time, that actually settles things. Now, when you read through the narrative here, it's going to read like one continuous narrative, but we have to, based on the data that the Bible gives us, we kind of have to insert a little bit of a gap of time between verse 15 and 16. So verse 15 is, Hezekiah gave him all the silver that was found in the house of the Lord and in the treasuries of the king's house. And at that time, Hezekiah stripped the gold from the doors of the temple of the Lord and the doorposts that Hezekiah, king of Judah, had overlaid, and gave it to the king of Assyria. So right there is the end of the first invasion. Hezekiah surrenders, takes the gold off of the temple, and sends it to the king of Assyria and says, just don't destroy me. Because Hezekiah realizes he's beat. He's got nothing to fight him off with. That probably satisfies the king of Assyria for a little while. But then in verse 17, the king of Assyria sent the Tartan, the Rabsharish, and the Rabshakeh with a great army from Lachish to King Hezekiah at Jerusalem. And they went up and came to Jerusalem. Now, we've covered this section, so I'm going to skim through and jump ahead a little bit. But I just want to note that probably what we're looking at is a little bit of a gap of time between the first invasion where Hezekiah surrenders and this next one, okay? And I'll show you why we're going to look at that, why we see that gap of time. So we know that in the next verses 19 and following, the Rabshakeh comes and gives this great speech in front of the walls of Jerusalem and says, don't trust Hezekiah, don't trust Egypt, don't trust God. He can't save you from the arm of Assyria. Now, how does it go when men and nations challenge God's greatness? It doesn't go well, and Daniel's right, those nations don't exist for long. It's why we're titling tonight, The Most High Rules in the Kingdoms of Men. And we're going to see that played out here as we go through these things. So, the Rabshakeh defies God by defying Israel. We read a... in Sunday school, we looked at the conversion of Saul, and Jesus says to Saul, 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 why are you persecuting me? Well, who was Paul persecuting? The church, the Christians. But Jesus doesn't put a distinction in saying, stop persecuting my people. He says, you're persecuting me. And so there is this tight link between God's people and God himself. Now, it's different. Old Testament, we recognize Israel's different than the church. Different purposes, different plan, but some of those principles are the same, that you don't persecute God's people without persecuting God. So you don't revile God's people without also reviling the God of those people. And so when this Rabshakeh comes and he says, you know, you Israelites, you're weak, you got nothing, and your God's weak, he's got nothing, he can't stop me, God is going to respond very, very strongly. So, that doesn't satisfy them, so the Rabshakeh, or the king of Assyria, sends this letter reinforcing those same ideas and saying, look, I'll be back. I'm going to level your city, I'm going to carry all your people off, and I'm going to scatter you throughout the Assyrian Empire, and there's nothing you or your God can do about it. So Hezekiah takes that letter, takes it into the temple, lays it out before God, and says, his prayer here is in chapter 19, verse 15. Hezekiah goes up before the house of the Lord, spread the letter before the Lord, verse 15. And Hezekiah prayed before the Lord and said, O Lord, the God of Israel, enthroned above the cherubim. Which cherubim? Yeah, the ones on the ark. All right, that ark was God's throne, ruling Israel from that throne. Okay? Enthroned above the cherubim, you are God, you alone, of all the kingdoms of the earth, you have made heaven and earth. So Hezekiah is acknowledging God rules in heaven and earth, not men. As much as some of our kings and politicians like to think they're in total control of things. Incline your ear, O Lord, and hear. Open your eyes, O Lord, and see and hear the words of Sennacherib, which he has sent to mock the living God. Truly, O Lord, the kings of Assyria have laid waste the nations and their lands and have cast their gods into the fire, for they were not gods, but the work of men's hands, wood and stone. Therefore they were destroyed. So now, O Lord our God, save us, please, from his hand, that all the kings of the earth may know that you, O Lord, are God alone. So Hezekiah recognizes that he's got one answer to this problem, and that is God. God has to act. Now, if you go to the parallel passages in the book of 2 Chronicles, it's like chapters 32, 33, you'll read how Hezekiah built up the armies of Jerusalem. He stored up weapons. So between the first visit of the Assyrians and the next one, he's massing up the military capability of Jerusalem. But most of Judah has been heavily damaged and destroyed by that first invasion where Sennacherib captured all the fortified cities. So Hezekiah doesn't have a whole lot of military might left. But he realizes anyway that it's not about military might, that God has to do something about this. So he lays this letter out and he prays to the Lord and asks God to do something about it. Verse 20, guess who responds? God responds, of course, but who's he using as a messenger? Isaiah the prophet. Yes, the same Isaiah that gives us the book of Isaiah. And actually, Isaiah records many of these same details in chapters 38 and 39 of his book. So you can read them there. But here's God's response, verse 20. Isaiah the son of Amoz sent to Hezekiah saying, Thus says the Lord, the God of Israel, Your prayer to me about Sennacherib, king of Assyria, I have heard. This is the word that the Lord has spoken concerning him. So here is God's definitive, absolute response to Hezekiah's prayer. She despises you. She scorns you, the virgin daughter of Zion. She wags her head behind you, the daughter of Jerusalem. So who do you think is doing the scorning and the wagging of the head? Assyria. And who is she scorning and wagging her head at? Israel. Jim, does it go well when people defy Israel? Not very often, right? Okay. Whom have you mocked and reviled? Against whom have you raised your voice and lifted your eyes to the heights? Against the Holy One of Israel. See, there again is that connection. You don't mock God's people without mocking God. By your messengers you have mocked the Lord, and you have said, With my many chariots I have gone up the heights of the mountains, to the far recesses of Lebanon. I felled its tallest cedars, its choicest cypresses. I entered its furthest lodging place, its most fruitful forest. I dug wells and drank foreign waters, and I dried up with the sole of my foot all the streams of Egypt. So this is the boasting of the king of Assyria that God is recounting here. He's saying, you king of Assyria, you're boasting about all the things that you have been able to do. Verse 25, have you not heard that who determined it long ago? I. Who's the I now? God. Who gave Assyria the power to do all the things that she has done? Who rules in the kingdoms of men? God does. Have you not heard that I determined it long ago? I planned from days of old what now I bring to pass, that you should turn fortified cities into heaps of ruins, while their inhabitants, shorn of strength, are dismayed and confounded, and have become like plants of the field and like tender grass, like grass on the housetops, blighted before it is grown. I know you're sitting down, and you're going out, and you're coming in, and you're raging against me. And because you have raged against me, and your complacency has come into my ears, I will put my hook in your nose and my bit in your mouth, and I will turn you back on the way by which you came. Summarize that for me. Yeah, I'm going to lead you away like a horse. You put bits in horses' mouths, right? You ever had a bit in your mouth? Probably not. I would imagine they're not very comfortable to have that thing in there, and you pull it on this side so the horse knows to go that way. You pull it that way, the horse knows to go that way. What do you put hooks in their nose? Yeah, it's for bulls. You actually, you know, hook them through the nose, because can you outpower a bull, Jim? No? Eldon, how about you? Can you overpower a bull?
Yes and no.
Yes and no.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. But if it comes to brute strength, who wins? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Ah, yes. Uh-huh. Yes. And that's exactly what this is talking about, is that ring in the bull's nose. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you can lead him wherever you want, right? Yeah. A little old 200-pound man can control a 1,500-pound bull with that ring in the nose. And that's the picture that God is giving is, you might think you're this big bad country, Assyria, but I've got a ring in your nose, and all I've got to do is twist it, and you're going down. Because I've got control of you. You might not recognize it, but I'm going to display it right now, because you're not going to come in here and bother my people like this. I'm the one that let you destroy all these other nations. I'm the one that used you as a tool to accomplish my purposes for the history of this world, and now I'm going to send you back home after I've given you a bit of a spanking. Right? So I'm going to take that nose, I'm going to take that hook in your nose, I'm going to twist it, and I'm going to lead you back to your own place. I'm going to turn you back the way by which you came. Verse 28 is where we start getting into why we see two visits, at least, of the Assyrians rather than one. Okay, that this all didn't happen in the 14th year of Hezekiah, but it actually takes place over a span of time. Because this shall be the sign for you. So who's he probably talking to now? Who's looking for a sign that these things will come to pass? Hezekiah. So this is a sign for Hezekiah. This is the sign for you. This year, eat what grows of itself. And in the second year, what springs of the same. Then in the third year, sow and reap and plant vineyards and eat their fruit. The surviving remnant of the house of Judah shall again take root downward and bear fruit upward. For out of Jerusalem shall go a remnant, and out of Mount Zion a band of survivors. The zeal of the Lord of hosts will do this. So there's some more to this promise and this answer we'll get to in a minute. But what is the sign that God is going to keep Assyria away from Judah? Okay, so you're not going to plant anything this year. What year did the Israelites not plant, Tim? Oh, that was part of it. Every seventh year, the sabbatical year. They were not allowed to plant the ground. You just ate volunteer crops. And God said, if you obey me, I know you're going to get worried, because you're going to think, hey, if I don't plant my fields, I'm not going to have enough food. And God says, don't worry. I'll command a blessing in the seventh year, and it'll grow enough for you. You'll get, the sixth year will grow so much food that it'll carry you through the seventh year, and you'll eat what grows of itself the seventh year, and then you can plant again in the eighth year, and you'll have plenty. Don't worry, just obey me. Eldon.
Well, I can kind of associate with that.
Yeah, yeah.
This year we had lettuce and garden
was going to say, you got lettuce all over, don't you? Yeah, good. Yeah, we've got quite a bit of lettuce volunteering in our garden too, but I found tomatoes volunteering in my green bean patch, because that's where I planted tomatoes a couple of years ago. But you know, crops do volunteer themselves. They will grow. I mean, look out in the fields there. It's not all soybean. You'll find some corn growing up in there because that's how seed works, right? So part of the sign, and here's one of those things where we say, do signs always have to be miraculous? There's nothing miraculous about this sign. Do crops grow naturally? And I'm not saying without God doing it, but this is part of the normal course of events, right? The difference between a miracle and a not miracle is, does it violate what we typically call the laws of nature? And there's nothing that violates the laws of nature here. This isn't a miraculous sign. You know, Jesus healing people by speaking a word, that's miraculous. That doesn't happen according to the laws of nature. Him walking on water, that's miraculous. As we looked at a couple of weeks ago, Paul healing people by touching a handkerchief and then the handkerchief touching the person, that violates what we call the laws of nature. It's miraculous. But this one, this sign that God gives him isn't really miraculous, but it is meaningful. So we know that this is going to be a seventh sabbatical year, at least. So he says the first year, don't plant, eat what grows of itself. And then what about the second year? Do the same. When did Israel have 2 years in a row that they would not plant? Tim, you said it earlier. The Jubilee. Okay? So they counted 7 years. On the seventh year, they didn't plant anything. They just ate what grew of itself. Then they would do that again, and again, and again, and again, for seven groups of 7 years. So 49 years, every seventh year, they would have a rest year. They weren't allowed to plant the ground. Then, in the fall of the 49th year, they would blow a trumpet and declare Jubilee. They call it the 50th year, but that 50th year actually half overlaps the 49th and goes into the first of the next set. Okay? So that period of time was the Jubilee, the 50th year, partly in the 49th, partly in the first. And they were not supposed to plant for those 2 years in a row. So the 49th year, you wouldn't plant in the spring. In the fall, you declare a Jubilee, which means the next year, you don't plant also. And so then that fall of that year, you'd only be harvesting what volunteered itself. So the sign that God gives Hezekiah is, you Israelites are going to celebrate a sabbatical year and a Jubilee. Well, that was on a pretty strict schedule, wasn't it? Every seventh year, Sabbath year. Every 49th year, the Jubilee begins. We can trace that back to when it began, and guess when the Jubilee would have landed during Hezekiah's life? Right here. The 18th and 19th year of his reign. So, this whole thing began the 14th year of his reign, when Sennacherib invaded, took all the fortified cities of Judah. Hezekiah yielded, paid a heavy tribute, and Sennacherib probably left him alone for a little while, but that campaign wasn't over. So that's why the writer of Kings is treating this all as one long epic in Hezekiah's life. But it's actually going to last several years here. So Sennacherib invades here in the 14th year, and Hezekiah yields. At some point, Sennacherib says, I'm coming back again, and it's possible that it's because Hezekiah rebelled again. God didn't want his people in these kinds of subordinate relationships to the other nations. And he tells them that pretty clearly. So I think Hezekiah is wrestling with this whole thing of, I shouldn't be yielding to the Assyrians, but he does at some points. And so I think that Sennacherib invades, Hezekiah yields, pays tribute, and then maybe a year or two later decides, no, this was wrong, I shouldn't do this. We need to stop paying tribute to the Assyrians. So he does. And Sennacherib comes back. Sennacherib was constantly in this area fighting, which again is why I think the writer of Kings treats this as one solid scenario going on in Judah. But the sign is, this year, you are going to eat what grows of itself. That would be the 18th year. And next year, you're going to do the same thing. Because this is the seventh Sabbath year of this cycle, and then it's going to be the Jubilee. So for 2 years, don't plant anything. Well, how strong do you think your country is going to be if you don't plant anything for 2 years? You might be afraid and start to think, but we won't have enough food to last for a siege. We won't have enough food to strengthen our soldiers. We won't have enough material. And since back then, the economy was entirely based on agriculture. You'd say, that's going to weaken our country severely. But God says, I want you to trust me. You keep my Sabbath year. You keep my Jubilee. You watch what I'm going to do. This was it was a test of faith for Hezekiah. And so look at verse 32, because the sign continues. Isaiah is going to answer Hezekiah what God's going to accomplish. Therefore, thus says the Lord concerning the king of Assyria, he shall not come into this city or shoot an arrow there or come before it with a shield or cast up a siege mound against it. In other words, Sennacherib's not coming here to destroy Jerusalem. By the way that he came, by the same he shall return, and he shall not come into this city, declares the Lord. For I will defend this city to save it, for my own sake and for the sake of my servant David. So God's answer is, don't worry. Sennacherib's not coming here to destroy Jerusalem, but you trust me and you keep my Sabbath year. And when that Sabbath year is done, then you'll know that I've kept my word. Because it'll be 2 years without Sennacherib coming in. And so then, guess what happens that night? Verse 35. That night, the angel of the Lord went out and struck down 185,000 in the camp of the Assyrians. And when people arose early in the morning, behold, these were all dead bodies. Now, when we go back to the text, to our map, and look at where the king of Syria, or of Assyria, is camped, he's down here in Libna, and he's kind of going back and forth between Libna and Lachish. So he's a little ways away from Jerusalem, but he's engaged in this military campaign. What would it do to your military campaign to wake up in the morning and find 185,000 of your soldiers dead? Might that put a kink in your plans? You better believe it. Eldon. It's all over, yeah. And it's so all over that Sennacherib has to return home without having accomplished his mission of conquering Judah and Egypt. He goes back home. Now, what's really fun about this is the Assyrian records. The Assyrians left us some pretty good records of their kings. So we know a lot of what happens in the Assyrian kingdoms. And they talked about their battles and their conquests. And the Assyrians even mention Hezekiah. And one time they talk about attacking Jerusalem and throwing siege mounds against it and trapping Hezekiah in like a little birdie. But guess what they mention about this event? Nothing. Not a thing gets recorded about 185,000 soldiers dead in one night. Nothing gets recorded. Do you know who, in the ancient world, who was exemplary about recording the defeats and failures of their kings? Israel, the only one. You look at all the other nations, the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Egyptians, the Assyrians, the Syrians, none of them record the defeats of their kings. Because it doesn't look good, does it? I mean, do you go home and brag about getting beat up? You go home and brag about losing? No, you don't. You go home and you brag about whatever you can do. Now, we know that they often exaggerated their victories. And so the Assyrian coming home and saying, oh, I shut Hezekiah up in Jerusalem like a little birdie. Well, he's probably exaggerating about the last time. He came, he conquered the fortified cities. He never actually destroyed Jerusalem. But he goes home and he tells everybody, oh, we kicked those Israelites. Kick their bahukas. So the Assyrian army is decimated here, and Sennacherib has to return home. He goes back to Assyria in shame. Then read what happens to him. It says, as he was worshiping in the house of Nisroch, his god, Adramelech and Sharezer, his sons, struck him down with the sword and escaped into the land of Ararat, and Esarhaddon, his son, reigned in his place. Now, here's what's kind of fun with this one. Because if it's Sennacherib, and this is a big if we have our understanding of the Assyrian kings nailed down pretty good in their timing, right here is where this event happens. 185,000 Assyrian soldiers die somewhere in this area. So we're just going to go straight up and we're going to line this up. Look at this. Who's king in Assyria right now? Sargon. Sennacherib doesn't actually become king for another 3 or 4 years. And then he rules for about 16 years before he dies. Now, he does die this way, and we know this. He's killed by his own sons. Bible's account is completely verified for us. But the writer of the Kings is compressing these events for us to show us that God rules in the history of people. He rules in the kingdoms of men. These people cannot just go off and do whatever they want. He is in control of it all the time, just like the bull with the hook in his nose. Any nation in the world, no matter how big it thinks it is, no matter how big it thinks its britches are, God can at any moment just grab that hook and twist it and the bull goes down on the ground. Because the Most High rules in the kingdoms of men. These kings rule at God's command, not their own. Isn't that great to know? Got elections coming up. Who's going to win? We can ask who you hope's going to win. And boy, you got great freedom in this country to vote your conscience. I hope you do. Encourage everybody to take part. Vote for freedom. Don't vote for tyranny. Please don't vote for more tyranny. But guess who wins? The one God wants. And that doesn't always mean the one that we think glorifies God the most, but it's the one that advances God's purposes for the history of this world. God has a plan for the history of this world, and guess where it ends? It ends with Christ ruling over everything. No one can stop that. No amount of bullying by giant nations and strong militaries can cut that off and keep it from happening. Christ will rule. Psalm chapter 2, why do the heathen rage and the people plot a vain thing? Well, they're trying to stop Christ from ruling. They always are. But God says, yet have I set my son on my holy hill of Zion. They can't stop him from coming. They can't stop him from ruling. So, that is the Assyrian Chronicles dealing with Hezekiah. There was a lot going on there. But guess how often the Assyrians come and bother Judah from this point forward? They don't. God sent him home shamefaced. Now, if you read some commentators, they'll try and push things around and say that there were other invasions that the Bible doesn't tell us about. It's possible that before this there were. The Bible doesn't record exhaustive history for us. What it does tell us is accurate. What it does tell us is true, but that doesn't mean it tells us everything. So, next time we come together, we'll look at Hezekiah's illness and recovery, which actually happened in the same year that Sennacherib came and invaded the first time. And there's some interesting things that go on there. But any questions about Assyria and their dealings with Israel?